led them down a weedy, little-used path that meandered away from the house in a westerly direction. It wound first through a fair-sized garden plot from which everything had been harvested but the pumpkins and squashes, then into an orchard where the apples were just coming to full ripeness, then through a dense blackberry tangle where thorns seemed to reach out everywhere to snag their clothes. As they passed out of the blackberry brambles and into a gloomy stand of old pines and spruces, it occurred to Ralph that they must be on the Newport side of the ridge now. Dorrance walked briskly for a man of his years, and the placid smile never left his face. The book he carried was For Love, Poems 1950-1960, by a man named Robert Creeley. Ralph had never heard of him, but supposed Mr. Creeley had never heard of Elmore Leonard, Ernest Haycox, or Louis L'Amour either. He only tried to talk to Old Dor once, when the three of them finally reached the foot of a slope made slick and treacherous with pine needles. Just ahead of them, a small stream foamed coldly past. "Dorrance, what are you doing out here? How did you get here, for that matter? And where the hell are we going?" "Oh, I hardly ever answer questions," Old Dor replied, smiling widely. He surveyed the stream, then raised one finger and pointed at the water. A small brown trout jumped into the air, flipped bright drops from its tail, and fell back into the water again. Ralph and Lois looked at each other with identical, "Did I just see what I thought I saw?" expressions.
"Nope, nope," Dor continued, stepping off the bank and onto a wet rock. "Hardly ever. Too difficult. Too many possibilities. Too many levels. Eh, Ralph? The world is full of levels, isn't it? How are you, Lois?"
"Fine," she said absently, watching Dorrance cross the stream on a number of conveniently placed stones. He did it with his arms held out to either side, a posture which made him look like the world's oldest acrobat. Just as he reached the far bank, there was a violent exhalation from the ridge behind them. Not quite an explosion. "There go the oil tanks," Ralph thought. Dor turned to face them from the other side of the brook, smiling his placid Buddha smile. Ralph went up this time without any conscious intention of doing so, and without that sense of a blink inside his mind. Color rushed into the day, but he barely noticed. All his attention was fixed on Dorrance, and for a space of almost 10 seconds, he forgot to breathe. Ralph had seen auras of many shades in the last month or so, but none even remotely approached the splendid envelope that enclosed the old man Don Veazey had once described as nice as hell, but really sort of a fool. It was as if Dorrance's aura had been strained through a prism, or a rainbow. He tossed off light in dazzling arcs, blue followed by magenta, magenta followed by red, red followed by pink, pink followed by the creamy yellow-white of a ripe banana. He felt Lois's hand groping for his and unfolded it. "My God, Ralph, do you see? Do you see how beautiful he is?"
"I sure do."
"What is he? Is he even human?"
"I don't know." "Stop it, both of you. Come back down."
Dorrance was still smiling, but the voice they heard in their heads was commanding and not a bit vague. And before Ralph could consciously think himself down, he felt a push. The colors and the heightened quality of the sounds dropped out of the day at once.
"There's no time for that now," Dor said. "Why, it's noon already."
"Noon?" Lois asked. "It can't be. It wasn't even 9 when we got here, and that can't have been half an hour ago."
"Time goes faster when you're high," Old Dor said. He spoke solemnly, but his eyes twinkled. "Just ask anyone drinking beer and listening to country music on Saturday night. Come on, hurry up. The clock is ticking. Cross the stream."
Lois went first, stepping carefully from stone to stone with her arms held out, as Dorrance had done. Ralph followed with his hands poised to either side of her hips, ready to catch her if she showed signs of wavering. But he was the one who ended up almost tumbling in. He managed to avoid it, but only at the cost of wetting one foot all the way to the ankle. It seemed to him that some place in the far reaches of his head, he could hear Carolyn laughing merrily. "Can't you tell us anything, Dor?" he asked as they reached the far side. "We're pretty lost here." And not just mentally or spiritually either, he thought. He'd never been in these woods in his life, not even hunting partridge or deer as a young man. If the path they were on petered out, or if old Dor lost whatever passed for his bearings, what then? "Yes," Dor responded at once. "I can tell you one thing, and it's absolutely for sure."
"What?"
"These are the best poems Robert Creeley ever wrote," old Dor said, holding up his copy of For Love, and before either of them could respond to that, he turned around and once again began tracing his way along the faint path which ran west through the woods. Ralph looked at Lois. Lois looked back at him, equally at a loss. Then she shrugged. "Come on, old buddy," she said. "We better not lose him now. I forgot the breadcrumbs."
They climbed another hill, and from the top of it, Ralph could see that the path they were on led down to an old woods road with a strip of grass running up the middle. It dead-ended in an overgrown gravel pit, about 50 yards farther along. There was a car idling just outside the entrance to the pit, a perfectly anonymous late-model Ford, which Ralph nevertheless felt he knew. When the door opened and the driver got out, everything fell into place. Of course he knew the car. He had last seen it from Lois's living room window on Tuesday night. Then it had been slewed around in the middle of Harris Avenue, with the driver kneeling in the glow of the headlights, kneeling beside the dying dog he had struck. Joe Weiser heard them coming, looked up, and waved.
"He said he wanted me to drive," Weiser told them as he carefully turned his car around at the entrance to the gravel pit.
"Where to?" Lois asked.
She was sitting in the back with Dorrance. Ralph was in the front seat with Joe Weiser, who looked as if he weren't quite sure where or even who he was. Ralph had slid up just the tiniest bit as he shook hands with the pharmacist, wanting to get a look at Weiser's aura. Both it and his balloon string were there, and both looked perfectly healthy. But the bright yellow-orange looked slightly muted to him. Ralph had an idea that was very likely old Dor's influence.
"Good question," Weiser said. He voiced a small, confused laugh.
"I don't have the slightest idea, really. This has been the weirdest day of my entire life. Absolutely no doubt about it."
The woods road ended in a T-junction with a stretch of two-lane blacktop. Weiser stopped, looked for traffic, then turned left. They passed a sign reading to I-95 almost right away, and Ralph guessed that Weiser would turn north as soon as they reached the turnpike. He knew where they were now, just about 2 miles south of Route 33. From here they could be back in Derry in less than half an hour, and Ralph had no doubt that was just where they were going. He abruptly began to laugh.
"Well, here we are," he said. "Just three happy folks out for a midday drive. Make that four. Welcome to the wonderful world of hyper-reality, Joe."
Joe gave him a sharp look, then relaxed into a grin.
"Is that what this is?"
And before either Ralph or Lois could reply,
"Yeah, I suppose it is." "Did you read that poem?" Dorrance asked from behind Ralph. "The one that starts, 'Each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else.'"
Ralph turned and saw that Dorrance was still smiling his wide, placid smile.
"Yes, I did, Dor. Isn't it a crackerjack? It's so good. Stephen Dobbins reminds me of Hart Crane without the pretensions. Or maybe I mean Stephen Crane, but I don't think so. Of course, he doesn't have the music of Dylan Thomas, but is that so bad? Probably not. Modern poetry is not about music. It's about nerve. Who has it and who doesn't?"
"Oh, boy," Lois said. She rolled her eyes.
"He could probably tell us everything we need to know if we went up a few levels," Ralph said. "But you don't want that, do you, Dor? Because time goes faster when you're high."
Bingo,
Dorrance replied. The blue signs marking the north and south entrances to the turnpike glimmered up ahead.
You'll have to go up later, I imagine. You and Lois both. So it's very important to save as much time as you can now. Save time.
He made a queerly evocative gesture, drawing a gnarled thumb and forefinger down in the air, bringing them together as he did, as if to indicate some narrowing passage. Joe Weiser put on his blinker, turned left, and headed down the northbound ramp to Derry.
How did you get involved in this, Joe? Ralph asked him. Of all the people on the west side, why did Dorrance draft you as chauffeur?
Weiser shook his head, and when the car reached the turnpike, it drifted immediately over into the passing lane. Ralph reached out quickly and made a mid-course correction, reminding himself that Joe probably hadn't been getting much sleep himself just lately. He was very happy to see the highway was mostly deserted, at least this far out of town. It would save some anxiety, and God knew he would take whatever he could get in that department today.
We are all bound together by the purpose, Dorrance said abruptly. That's Katit, which means one made of many. The way that many rhymes make up a single poem, you see?
No. Ralph, Lois, and Joe said it at the same time in perfect unrehearsed chorus, and then laughed nervously together. The three insomniacs of the apocalypse, Ralph thought. Jesus save us.
That's okay, old Dor said, smiling his wide smile. Just take my word for it. You and Lois, Helen and her little daughter, Bill, Faye Chapin, Trigger Vashon, me, all part of the purpose.
That's fine, Dor, Lois said, but where's the purpose taking us now? And what are we supposed to do when we get there?
Dorrance leaned forward and whispered in Joe Weiser's ear, guarding his lips with one puffy, age-spotted hand. Then he sat back again, looking deeply satisfied with himself.
He says we're going to the Civic Center, Joe said.
The Civic Center? Lois exclaimed, sounding alarmed. No, that can't be right. Those two little men said...
Never mind them right now, Dorrance said. Just remember what it's about. Nerve! Who has it and who doesn't?
Silence in Joe Weiser's Ford for almost the space of a mile. Dorrance opened his book of Robert Creeley poems and began to read one, tracing his way from line to line with the yellowed nail of one ancient finger. Ralph found himself remembering a game they had sometimes played as kids. Not a very nice one. Snipe hunt, it had been called. You got kids who were a little younger and a lot more gullible than you were. Fed them a cock and bull story about the mystical snipe. Then gave them toe sacks and sent them out to spend a strenuous afternoon wandering around in the damps and the willywags, looking for non-existent birds. This game was also called Wild Goose Chase, and he suddenly had the inescapable feeling that Clotho and Lachesis had been playing it with him and Lois up on the hospital roof. He turned around in his seat and looked directly at old Dor. Dorrance folded over the top corner of the page he was reading, closed his book, and looked back at Ralph with polite interest.
They told us we weren't to go near either Ed Deepnow or Dock Number 3, Ralph said.
He spoke slowly and with great clarity.
They told us, very specifically, that we weren't even to think of doing that, because the situation had invested both of them with great power, and we were apt to get swatted like flies. In fact, I think Lachesis said that if we tried getting near either Ed or Atropos, we might end up having a visit from one of the upper-level honchos. Someone Ed calls the Crimson King. Not a very nice fellow either, by all reports.
Yes, Lois said in a faint voice. That's what they told us on the hospital roof. They said we had to convince the women in charge to cancel Susan Day's appearance. That's why we went out to High Ridge.
And did you succeed in convincing them? Weiser asked.
No.
Ed's crazy friends came before we could get there, set the place on fire, and killed at least two of the women. Shot them.
One was the woman we really wanted to talk to.
Gretchen Tilbury, Ralph said.
Yes, Lois agreed. But surely we don't need to do any more. I can't believe they'll go ahead with the rally now. I mean, how could they? My God, at least 4 people are dead, probably more. They'll have to cancel her speech, or at least postpone it. Isn't that so?
Neither Dorrance nor Joe replied. Ralph didn't reply either. He was thinking of Helen's red-rimmed, furious eyes.
How can you even ask? She'd said. If they stop us now, they win.
If they stop us now, they win. Was there any legal way the police could stop them? Probably not. The city council, then? Maybe. Maybe they could hold a special meeting and revoke Woman Care's rally permit. But would they? If there were 2,000 angry, grief-stricken women marching around the municipal building and yelling, "If they stop us now, they win," in unison, would the council revoke the permit? Ralph began to feel a deep sinking sensation in his gut. Helen clearly considered tonight's rally more important than ever, and she wouldn't be the only one. It was no longer just about choice and who had the right to decide what a woman did with her own body. Now it was about causes important enough to die for, and honoring the friends who had done just that. Now they were talking not just about politics, but about a kind of secular requiem mass for the dead. Lois had grabbed his shoulder and was shaking it hard. Ralph came back to the here and now, but slowly, like a man being shaken awake in the middle of an incredibly vivid dream.
They will cancel it, won't they? And even if they don't, if for some crazy reason they don't, most people will stay away, right? After what happened at High Ridge, they'll be afraid to come.
Ralph thought about that and then shook his head. Most people will think the danger's over. The news reports are going to say that 2 of the radicals who attacked High Ridge are dead, and the 3rd is catatonic or something.
But Ed, what about Ed? She cried. He's the one who got them to attack, for heaven's sake. He's the one who sent them out there in the first place.
That may be true. Probably is true. But how could we prove it? Do you know what I think the cops will find at wherever Charlie Pickering's been hanging his hat? A note saying it was all his idea. A note exonerating Ed completely, probably in the guise of an accusation. How Ed deserted them in their time of greatest need. And if they don't find a note like that in Charlie's rented room, they'll find it in Frank Felton's, or Sandra McKay's.
But that's...
Lois stopped, biting at her lower lip. Then she looked at Wiser with hopeful eyes.
What about Susan Day? Where is she? Does anybody know? Do you? Ralph and I will call her on the telephone and...
She's already in Derry, Wiser said. Although I doubt if even the police know for sure where she is. But what I heard on the news while the old fella and I were driving out here is that the rally is going to happen tonight. And that's supposedly straight from the woman herself.
Sure, Ralph thought, sure it is. The show's going on. The show has to go on, and she knows it.
Someone who's ridden the crest of the women's movement all these years, held since the Chicago Convention in 68, knows a genuine watershed moment when she sees it. She's evaluated the risks and found them acceptable. Either that, or she's evaluated the situation and decided that the credibility loss involved in walking away would be unacceptable. Maybe both. In any case, she's as much a prisoner of events, of Catet, as the rest of us. They were on the outskirts of Derry again. Ralph could see the Civic Center on the horizon. Now it was old Dor Lois turned to.
Where is she? Do you know? It doesn't matter how many security people she's got around her. Ralph and I can be invisible when we want to be, and we're very good at changing people's minds.
Oh, changing Susan Day's mind wouldn't change anything, Dor said. He still wore that broad, maddening smile. They'll come to the Civic Center tonight, no matter what. If they come and find the doors locked, they'll break them open and go inside and have their rally just the same, to show they're not afraid.
Done, bun, can't be undone. Ralph said dully.
Right, Ralph, Doris said cheerily, and patted Ralph's arm. 5 minutes later, Joe drove his Ford past the hideous plastic statue of Paul Bunyan, which stood in front of the Civic Center, and turned in at a sign which read, There's always free parking at your Civic Center.
The acre of parking lot lay between the Civic Center building itself and the Bassey Park racetrack. If the event that evening had been a rock concert or a boat show or a wrestling card, they would have had the parking lot entirely to themselves this early. But tonight's event was clearly going to be light years from an exhibition basketball game or a monster truck pull. There were already 60 or 70 cars in the lot, and little groups of people standing around looking at the building. Most of them were women. Some had picnic hampers. Several were crying, and almost all wore black armbands.
Ralph saw a middle-aged woman with a weary, intelligent face and a great mass of gray hair passing these out from a carry bag. She was wearing a T-shirt with Susan Day's face on it and the words, We shall overcome. And where the O's were was the woman sign.
The drive-through area in front of the Civic Center's bank of entrance doors was even busier than the parking lot. No fewer than 6 TV news vans were parked there, and various tech crews stood under the triangular cement canopy in little clusters, discussing how they were going to handle tonight's event. And according to the bedsheet banner which hung down from the canopy, flapping lazily in the breeze, there was going to be an event. Rally is on, it read, in large, blurry spray paint letters. 8 p.m. Come show your solidarity. Express your outrage. Comfort your sisters.
Joe put the Ford in park, then turned to old Dor, eyebrows raised.
Dor nodded, and Joe looked at Ralph.
I guess this is where Hugh and Lois get out, Ralph.
Good luck. I'd come with you if I could. I even asked him, but he says I'm not equipped.
That's all right, Ralph said. We appreciate everything you've done, don't we, Lois?
We certainly do, Lois said. Ralph reached for the door handle, then let it go again. He turned to face Dorrance.
What's this about? Really, I mean, it's not about saving the 2,000 or so people Clotho and Lachesa said are going to be here tonight, that's for sure. To the kind of all-time forces they talked about, 2,000 lives are probably just a little more grease on the bearings. So what's it all about, Alfie? Why are we here?
Dorrance's grin had faded at last. With it gone, he looked younger and strangely formidable.
Job asked God the same question, he said, and got no answer. You're not going to get one either, but I'll tell you this much. You've become the pivot point of great events and vast forces. The work of the higher universe has almost completely come to a stop as those of both the random and the purpose turn to mark your progress.
That's great, but I don't get it, Ralph said, more in resignation than in anger.
Neither do I. But those 2,000 lives are enough for me, Lois said quietly. I could never live with myself if I didn't at least try to stop what's going to happen. I dream of the death bag around that building for the rest of my life. Even if I only got an hour's sleep a night, I'd dream of it.
Ralph considered this, then nodded. He opened his door and swung one foot out.
That's a good point. And Helen'll be there. She might even bring Nat. Maybe for short-time farts like us, that's enough.
And maybe, he thought, I want a rematch with Doc Number 3.
Oh, Ralph, Carolyn mourned. Clint Eastwood? Again?
No, not Clint Eastwood. Not Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger either. Not even John Wayne. He was no big action hero or movie star. He was just plain old Ralph Roberts from Harris Avenue. That didn't make the grudge he bore the Doc with the rusty scalpel any less real, however. And now that grudge was a lot bigger than just a stray dog and the retired history teacher who had lived downstairs for the last 10 years or so.
Ralph kept thinking of the parlor at High Ridge and the women propped against the wall below the poster of Susan Day. It wasn't upon Merrilee's pregnant belly which the eye in his mind kept focusing,
but Gretchen Tilbury's hair. Her beautiful blonde hair that had been mostly burned off by the close-range rifle shot that had taken her life. Charlie Pickering had pulled the trigger, and maybe Ed Deepnow had put the gun in his hands. But it was Atropos, Ralph blamed. Atropos, the jump rope thief. Atropos, the hat thief. Atropos, the comb thief. Atropos, the earring thief. Come on, Lois, he said. Let's... But she put her hand on his arm and shook her head. Not just yet. Get back in here and shut the door. He looked at her carefully, then did what she said. She paused, gathering her thoughts, and when she spoke, she looked directly at old Dor. I still don't understand why we were sent out to High Ridge, she said. They never even came right out and said that was what we were supposed to do. But we know, don't we, Ralph, that that was what they wanted from us. And I want to understand. If we're supposed to be here, why did we have to go out there? I mean, we saved some lives, and I'm glad. But I think Ralph's right. A few lives don't mean much to the people running this show. Silence for a moment, and then Doran said, Did Clotho and Lachesis really strike you as all-wise and all-knowing, Lois? Well, they were smart, but I guess they weren't exactly geniuses, she said after a moment's thought. At one point, they called themselves Working Joes, who were a long way down the ladder from the boardroom executives who actually made the decisions. Old Dor was nodding and smiling. Clotho and Lachesis are almost short-timers themselves in the big scheme of things. They have their own fears and mental blind spots. They are also capable of making bad decisions. But in the end, that doesn't matter, because they also serve the purpose. And Katet. They thought we'd lose if we went head-to-head with Atropos, didn't they? Ralph asked. That's why they talked themselves into believing we could accomplish what they wanted by using the back door. The back door being High Ridge. Yes, Dor said. That's it. Great, Ralph said. I love a vote of confidence, especially when... No, Dor said. That's not it. Ralph and Lois exchanged a bewildered glance. What are you talking about? It's both things at the same time. That's very often the way things are within the purpose. You see, well, he sighed, I hate all these questions. I hardly ever answer questions. Did I tell you that? Yes, Lois said, you did. Yes, and now bingo. All these questions. Nasty and useless. Ralph looked at Lois and she looked back at him. Neither of them made any move to get out. Dor heaved a sigh. All right, but this is the last thing I'm going to say, so pay attention. Clotho and Lachesis may have sent you to High Ridge for the wrong reasons, but the purpose sent you there for the right ones. You fulfilled your task there. By saving the women, Lois said. But Dorrance was shaking his head. Then what did we do? She nearly shouted. What? Don't we have a right to know what part of the gosh-damned purpose we fulfilled? No, Dorrance said. At least not yet, because you have to do it again. This is crazy, Ralph said. It isn't, though, Dorrance replied. He was holding For Love tightly against his chest now, bending it back and forth and looking at Ralph earnestly. Random is crazy. Purpose is sane. All right, Ralph thought. What did we do at High Ridge besides save the people in the cellar? And John Lydecker, of course. I think Pickering might have killed him as well as Chris Nell if I hadn't intervened. Could it be something to do with Lydecker? He supposed it could, but it didn't feel right. Dorrance, he said, can't you please give us a little more information? I mean... No, old Dor said, not unkindly. No more questions, no more time. We'll have a good meal together after this is over. If we're still around, that is. You really know how to cheer a fellow up, Dor. Ralph opened his door. Lois did the same, and they both stepped out into the parking lot, He bent down and looked at Joe Weiser. Is there anything else? Anything you can think of? No, I don't think. Dorr leaned forward and whispered in his ear. Joe listened, frowning. Well? Ralph asked when Doran sat back. What did he say? He said not to forget my comb, Joe said. I don't have the slightest idea of what he's talking about. But what else is new? That's okay, Ralph said and smiled a little. It's one of the few things I do understand. Come on, Lois. Let's check out the crowd. Mingle a little. Halfway across the parking lot, she elbowed him so hard in the side that Ralph staggered. Look, she whispered. Right over there. Isn't that Connie Chung? Ralph looked. Yes. The woman in the beige coat standing between two techs with the CBS logo on their jackets was almost certainly Connie Chung. He'd admired her pretty, intelligent face and pleasant smile over too many evening meals to have much doubt about it. Either her or her twin sister, he said. Lois seemed to have forgotten all about Old Dorr and High Ridge and the Bald Docks. In that moment, she was once more the woman Bill McGovern had liked to call our Lois. I'll be darned. What's she doing here? Well, Ralph began and then covered his mouth to hide a jaw-cracking yawn. I guess what's going on in Derry is national news now. She must be here to do a live segment in front of the Civic Center for tonight's news. In any case, suddenly, with no warning at all, the auras swam back. Ralph gasped. Jesus! Lois, are you seeing this? But he didn't think she was. If she had been, Ralph didn't think Connie Chung would have rated even an honorable mention on Lois's attention roster. This was horrible, almost beyond conceiving, and for the first time, Ralph fully realized that even the bright world of auras had its dark side, one that would make an ordinary person fall on his knees and thank God for his reduced perceptions. And this isn't even stepping up the ladder, he thought. At least I don't think it is. I'm only looking at that wider world, like a man looking through a window. I'm not actually in it. Nor did he want to be in it. Just looking at something like this was almost enough to make you wish you were blind. Lois was frowning at him. What, the colors? No. Should I try to? Is there something wrong with them? He tried to answer and couldn't. A moment later, he felt her hand seize his arm in a painful pincer's grip above the elbow and knew that no explanation was necessary. For better or worse, Lois was now seeing for herself. Oh, dear, she whimpered in a breathless little voice that teetered on the edge of tears. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, jeez, Louise. From the roof of Derry Home, the aura hanging over the Civic Center had looked like a vast, saggy umbrella. The Travelers Insurance Company logo colored black by a child's crayon, perhaps. Standing here in the parking lot, it was like being inside a large and indescribably nasty mosquito net, one so old and badly cared for that its gauzy walls had silted up with blackish-green mildew. The bright October sun shrank to a bleary circle of tarnished silver. The air took on a gloomy, foggy cast that made Ralph think of pictures of London at the end of the 19th century. They were not just looking at the Civic Center death bag. Not anymore. They were buried alive in it. Ralph could feel it pressing hungrily in on him, trying to overwhelm him with feelings of loss and despair and dismay. Why bother? He asked himself, watching apathetically as Joe Weiser's Ford drove back down toward Main Street with Old Dorr still sitting in the back seat. I mean, hey, really, what the hell is the use? We can't change this thing. No way we can. Maybe we did something out at High Ridge, but the difference between what was going on out there and what's happening here is like the difference between a smudge and a black hole. If we try to mess in with this business, we're going to get flattened. He heard moaning from beside him and realized Lois was crying. Mustering his flagging energy, he slid an arm around her shoulders. Hold on, Lois, he said. We can stand up to this. But he wondered. We're breathing it in, she wept. It's like we're sucking up death. Oh, Ralph,
Let's get away from here. Please, let's just get away from here.
The idea sounded as good to him as the idea of water must sound to a man dying of thirst in the desert. But he shook his head. 2,000 people are going to die here tonight if we don't do something. I'm pretty confused about the rest of this business, but that much I can grasp with no trouble at all.
Okay, she whispered. Just keep your arm around me so I don't crack my head open if I faint.
It was ironic, Ralph thought. They now had the faces and bodies of people in the early years of a vigorous middle age, but they shuffled across the parking lot like a pair of old-timers, whose muscles have turned to string and whose bones have turned to glass. He could hear Lois's breathing, rapid and labored, like the breathing of a woman who has just sustained some serious injury. "I'll take you back if you want," Ralph said, and he meant it. He would take her back to the parking lot. He would take her to the orange bus stop bench he could see from here. And when the bus came, getting on and going back to Harris Avenue would be the simplest thing in the world. He could feel the killer aura which surrounded this place pressing in on him, trying to smother him like a plastic dry-cleaning bag. And he found himself remembering something McGovern had said about Maylocker's emphysema, that it was one of those diseases that keep on giving. And now he supposed he had a pretty good idea of how Maylocker had felt during her last few years. It didn't matter how hard he sucked at the black air or how deep he dragged it down. It did not satisfy. His heart and head went on pounding, making him feel as if he was suffering the worst hangover of his life. He was opening his mouth to repeat that he'd take her back when she spoke up, talking in little out-of-breath gasps. I guess I can make it, but I hope it won't take long. Ralph, how come we can feel something this bad even without being able to see the colors? Why can't they? She pointed at the media people milling around the Civic Center. Are we short-timers that insensitive? I hate to think that. He shook his head, indicating that he didn't know. But he thought that perhaps the news crews, video technicians, and security guards clustered around the doors and beneath the spray-painted banner hanging from the canopy did feel something. He saw lots of hands holding styrofoam cups of coffee, but he didn't see anyone actually drinking the stuff. There was a box of donuts sitting on the hood of a station wagon, but the only one which had been taken out had been laid aside on a napkin, with just a single bite gone. Ralph ran his eye over 2 dozen faces without seeing a single smile. The news people were going about their work, setting camera angles, marking locations from which the talking heads would do their stand-ups, laying down coaxial cable and duct-taping it to the cement. But they were doing it without the sort of excitement which Ralph would have expected to accompany a story as big as this one was turning out to be. Connie Chung walked out from beneath the canopy with a bearded, handsome cameraman. Michael Rosenberg, the tag on his CBS jacket said, and then raised her small hands in a framing gesture, showing him how she wanted him to shoot the bedsheet banner hanging down from the canopy. Rosenberg nodded. Chung's face was pale and solemn, and at one point during her conversation with the bearded cameraman, Ralph saw her pause and raise a hand uncertainly to her temple, as if she had lost her train of thought or perhaps felt faint. There seemed to be an underlying similarity to all the expressions he saw, a common chord, and he thought he knew what it was. They were all suffering from what had been called melancholia when he was a kid, and melancholia was just a fancy word for the blues. Ralph found himself remembering times in his life when he'd hit the emotional equivalent of a cold spot while swimming, or clear air turbulence while flying. You'd be cruising along through your day, sometimes feeling great, sometimes just feeling okay, but getting along and getting it done. And then, for no apparent reason at all, you'd go down in flames and crash. A sense of what the hell's the use would slide over you, unconnected to any real event in your life at that moment, but incredibly powerful all the same. And you felt like simply creeping back to bed and pulling the covers up over your head. Maybe this is what causes feelings like that, he thought. Maybe it's running into something like this. Some big mess of death or sorrow waiting to happen. Spread out like a banquet tent, made of cobwebs and tears instead of canvas and rope. We don't see it, not down on our short-time level, but we feel it. Oh, yes, we feel it. And now... now it was trying to suck them dry. Maybe they weren't vampires, as they both had feared, but this thing was. The death bag had a sluggish, half-sentient life, and it would suck them dry if it could, if they let it.